Well, I'm going to throw a word out there and just see how it lands with you today. Here it is. Ready? Home. Home. Where does that word find you? How does that settle down in your heart? For some of you, that word might represent the place where you're living right now, the place that has all your favorite things, your favorite chair and your favorite flat screen and that bathtub where you go to relax, or the view off of your back deck, or your own bed. You all know that feeling when you've been away from home for a while. Maybe you were on a trip or a vacation. There's nothing like getting back in your own bed. Or maybe home makes you think of a time long ago in your life. Maybe it was the place where you grew up. And there are certain smells and certain songs, certain noises, maybe when the birds just chirp a certain way, that take you right back there in an instant. Some of you, that word is not a good thing. Some of you had a dreadful growing up experience, and the word home means something bad. In fact, one of my very favorite scenes in the movie Forrest Gump has to do with when Forrest is walking with his girlfriend Jenny, who is a very kind of disturbed adult, had a very difficult upbringing, and they wander upon Jenny's home where she grew up. And without saying anything, she just begins to bend down and pick up rocks and throw them at the house and throw them and throw them and throw them and throw them wildly until she collapses on the ground. And Forrest Gump says this great line. He says, "Sometimes I guess there just aren't enough rocks." Well, regardless of what your experience, what images come to mind when I say that word home, today I want to use this word home in a spiritual sense. I want to use the word home as equivalent to being with God. You and I were created from the very beginning to be with God. Not to know about Him from catechism or Sunday school, not to acknowledge His existence at a distance as we go on living our lives on our own. We were created to be with God, coexisting with Him, relying on Him, depending upon Him. And it's in that sense that I want to talk about the word home today. And so I ask you, as it relates to your spiritually being with God, do you have a back home to remember? Well, was there a time when your walk with God was close, when it was fresh and when it was alive, when you sensed Him looking upon you and kind of breathing on you with pleasure? Or have you never experienced that joy of being with God? Are you at the end of your rope trying to kind of satisfy yourself away from home? Well, whether it's something that you've tasted before, maybe long ago, or whether it's something that maybe is slipping away from you, maybe it's a joy that you know just must be out there, but you've never found. We know, we have a sense of when we're away from home. There's a sense that, man, when we're away from home, this isn't how we were created to be. We were meant for more than this. I've got good news today. God made a way for you to come home. Even if you've wandered away from Him, even if you find yourself in a place that's far from Him, He's made a way for you to come home. Last week, as we looked at Luke chapter 15, we're in this series called Prodigal God, and we're in week 3 already. And Jesus, we looked at who was in the audience that Jesus was addressing when He told these three parables. And we found that there were these two groups. There were the tax collectors and sinners, those who were far from God, those who had wandered away from home. And then there were the religious people who thought they were close to home, but in fact, Jesus is going to point out that they're also away from home. And the religious people are upset at the attention that Jesus is giving to these sinners, the people who are far from home. They can't believe that He's eating with them. In fact, they're questioning His judgment as a rabbi of why would you eat with these tax collectors and sinners? Why would you make a way to kind of approve of these people? And so in response to their question, in response to their grumbling, Jesus tells these three parables. And last week, we looked at the parable of the lost sheep and the parable of the lost coin. And we looked at what that means and how that sets up this story, the parable of the lost son. And if you missed last week's sermon, you can catch it at whoisgrace.com. I would encourage you to kind of catch up with all of these sermons along the way. But this week, we're going to look at the parable proper of the prodigal son. And as Tim Keller says in his book, Prodigal God, he says, really, this story comes in two acts. The first act has to do with the younger brother, and the second act has to do with the older brother. And today we're going to spend most of our time on Act 1. And so if you've got a Bible, we're going to be in Luke chapter 15, starting in verse 11, and you can go there, and we're just going to walk down through and draw out some principles for us. And so starting in verse 11, referring to Jesus, it says, "And he said, there was a man who had two sons." Now, we can find right from this description that there is a that this story is really about the father, that Tim Keller's onto something when he calls this the story of the prodigal God, because the subject of this very first sentence is, "There was a man." We're already talking about the father, and the man had two sons. This isn't just the story of the prodigal son. This is the story of the father. Look at verse 12. "And the younger of them said to his father, 'Father, give me the share of property that is coming to me.'" And so Act 1 of this story starts with this shocking request: "Give me my share." The way that the boy leaves home is particularly offensive to the father. And I just want to start with this very basic principle that rebellion is an offensive assault on your father. The way that this boy rebelled against his dad was particularly offensive, and it shows us how sin affects God. Here's a few ways that it was particularly offensive. The first is, it was a financial assault. It was an assault financially on his father. The story tells us that the dad had these two sons, and we know from ancient times that the older son got the double portion of the inheritance, which means with two sons, that the older son would get two-thirds of the inheritance, which meant one-third of the inheritance went to the younger son. Now, when you think about this, that the younger son comes to his dad and he says, "I want my share of the inheritance," he's asking for one-third of the father's wealth. This is a huge financial sacrifice for the dad. We also know that in the ancient times, inheritance came mainly in the form of property. But we find out later in this story that the boy actually had cash to spend, which leads us to one conclusion: that the boy actually had to liquidate his dad's property to get himself the cash to go off into this distant country. It's incredible if you start to imagine the scene. This younger son had to go out and he had to find a buyer for a portion of his father's farm, while his dad and his brother and the other people that work on this estate are standing there watching. He's parading potential buyers through the family farm so that he can sell off one-third of his dad's savings. And so he's walking through the farm and he's showing off the family gems and livestock for one-third of it. It'd be like watching Storage Wars, except for the owners of the units were actually standing there watching their stuff being sold to the highest bidder. The dad probably had his estate handed down from his father, which was handed down from his father, and so on. This was an incredible piece of property that the son was now just selling off, and it made for a tremendous financial hardship for the father. The second way that this was an assault on the dad, it was an assault on his reputation. Because as the boy was going around this community, this village that they lived in, encouraging people to come to the auction of his dad's stuff, think about how embarrassing that was to the family name. Everyone in the village now knew the family's dirty laundry, that they knew that this son was wayward, that he was a prodigal, that he was leaving, that he was besmirching his entire family name. And it was a blow to the father's reputation. But finally, it was a blow relationally to the father. It was an assault to their relationship, because what the younger son was doing by asking for his inheritance early is he was telling his dad, "Dad, I wish you were dead. I wish you were dead." I mean, a Middle Eastern dad, he holds all the land, he holds all the cattle, all of the belongings that he's accumulated for his whole life. He would follow a 1,000-year-old tradition, that he would hold on to those things and accumulate those things until his deathbed. And when he was on his deathbed, he would go through this ceremony, this ceremonious transfer of the inheritance to his children. And so we see this playing out in the Old Testament with Isaac and with Jacob. And here comes this brash young son and says, "Hey, Dad, I know you've broken your back for your whole life earning this stuff, but I couldn't wait for you to die so that I could get my hands on your stuff. So I'm just asking you to give me the stuff now." This was deeply offensive. Deeply offensive. The son had already buried his dad in his mind. The logical ancient response for this father was verbal and physical beating of the son and to run him off the property. But the dad does something radically different than that. You see, Jesus is conveying here how deeply offensive our sin is to God. And the audience caught the full weight of what the son did, how offensive it was. And we're supposed to catch it too. So the dad goes on this roller coaster ride. His son leaves, and then ultimately his son comes back, and it looks like it's going to be the happiest day of the dad's life. There's this reclamation project and ceremony when the son returns. But then, at the end of the story, the older brother starts his assault on the father. And the story at the end is in the same kind of crisis that it's in right here at the beginning, with an all-out assault from one of the sons on the father. Now, what's causing this assault from these two sons? What's Jesus describing here to us? I just want to let you know that what he's describing is this idea of idolatry. You see, the younger son has been a part of, an active part of the family for his whole life. He's been a part of the family meals. He's worked for the family. He's listened to his father. He's been obedient his whole life. But when he finally says, I'm tired of waiting for you to die, it shows that all along the son wanted the father's things more than he wanted the father. He wanted the comfort and the prestige and the wealth and the independence of living with the father. And he came to a crossroads. When he realized that he couldn't have both the father and the father's stuff. That the father, this whole time in his mind, was a means to an end for him. And now his patience was over. And he knew that this request would be like a knife to his dad. And he didn't really care. You see, it brings us to a truth about idolatry. Idolatry is wanting the father's things more than the father. It's a scary sin for us because it means that you can be in church and participating in family life all your life, obeying and reading the Bible and praying, and all along you have put your heart in the Father's things instead of the Father himself, that you're in it for the blessings and you're in it because you expect your life will go well as a result, that you'll have perfectly healthy children. And the Father says, listen, I didn't promise all those things. I promised me. And for many Christians, I think, maybe some of you in this room, you find yourself at a crossroads where you have to choose between God and his stuff. And so maybe it's in a relationship, or maybe it's a job or money or power or status, and you set your heart on it, and you come to this moment when you realize that in order to get that thing, in order to proceed with that relationship, in order to get that promotion, that you're going to have to walk away from God in order to get some of his stuff, what he's created. And the great irony of this story is that when we come back next week, we're dealing more with the older brother, but these two sons look very different on the surface. One runs out and rebels, and the other stays and obeys, and yet in the end, when the younger son comes home and the father throws for him a feast, the older son is furious. And he takes his turn at humiliating the father by standing outside and not going into the celebration because the dad was wasting now his inheritance on his younger brother. And both sons, we find out in the end, loved the father's things, but they didn't love the father. And this is idolatry. St. Augustine talks about these disordered loves in his confession. He kind of orders our loves and says that all things are good, but on the bottom level is material things. And then in the middle are people, and then at the top is God. And when we disorder our loves, we really mess our lives all up. And so when we love possessions, which are on the bottom, over relationships, which are right above it, we mess things all up. And we're making something first or second that should be third. And when we love people over God, we're making something that should be good ultimate. And when we do that, when we disorder our loves, we mess our lives all up. And we tend to put our high hopes in things that we're accomplishing at work. Or when we put our highest hopes in our love for another human being. Or our highest hopes in how our kids will turn out. When that comes to the top of the heap, when that's our first love, our first passion, that we will destroy both ourselves and those people involved. Because they were never meant to carry the weight of something ultimate. And we were never created to put that kind of weight in them. So when it comes to God the Father, You can't just believe in him. The call is to center our lives completely on him. To reach the point where we say, you know what, God, I don't care what you give me. I don't care how many prayers of mine you answer. I love you. And that not because you're useful and I get things from you, but because of who you are and because of what you've done for me. So the two boys are struggling with idolatry. And the younger son comes and he makes this audacious request. And look at verse 12b, what the father's response is. It says, and he divided his property between them. The son makes this outrageous request, and the father simply takes, this is so simple. He takes what is rightfully his. He takes that property that will sustain him to his old age, and he freely gives it to his son. This is unheard of. There's this fascinating phrase, he divided his property. It's not the normal word for property that the scripture uses here. It's the word bios, which is the word for life. We get the word biology. You see, in that day, their land was their identity. What the text is telling us is the only way that the father could keep open the possibility for his son was to rip his life in half, was to give away his life. The father sacrificed and he allowed his bios, his life, to be ripped into, to be divided into for the son's sin. He suffered, the father did, for the mere possibility of redemption of his son. Verse 13, not many days later, the younger son gathered all he had and he took a journey into a far country. And there he squandered his property in reckless living. And when he had spent everything, a severe famine arose in that country, and he began to be in need. And so he went and he hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him into his fields to feed pigs. And he was longing to be fed with the pods that the pigs ate. And no one gave him anything. And so the younger son is this guy. I mean, he's that guy that you may even know this guy. Where he gets a big inheritance from his family and he moves to the big city and he doesn't understand saving or investing or anything. He's been kind of sheltered from that his whole life. And so he starts buying new clothes and he gets the new car and the new motorcycle and he gets the new condo and fills it with new furnishings. And the rounds of drinks at the bar are on him for everybody. And he gets a nice vacation, lots of toys, technology, loose women, strip clubs. I mean, this guy is living it up. He's bought into the more is better view of life. More excitement, more experiences, more relationships, more money, more thrills. That if we get more, that finally we'll be happy. But more will never replace home. It's a case of disordered loves. Of loving something as ultimate and thinking that we're going to get the ultimate out of it when nothing can fill that void but God. He's about to find out that eventually sin will cost you everything. Some of you in this room need to hear that message today. That eventually sin will cost you everything. Well, we find out that he's about to hit his lowest point. You see, at the same time that he's spending all this money, a famine hits. There's a financial upheaval in the land. And he finds himself in a position where he has to start selling his assets at a significantly reduced rate. And so he's heading into the pawn shop and he's selling his Xbox the 1 week. And then the next week it's the flat screen TV. And the next week it's the motorcycle. And he's got his car on Craigslist. And he's taking his clothes down to Plato's Closet. He's been kicked out of his condo and he can't afford his bills. And he's taking the bus everywhere. He's looking for work. The market went upside down on him. He's not getting hired anywhere because he's not hireable. So he finally gets the only job that's available. This Gentile pagan hires him to work on his pig farm. It's the worst possible job for a Jewish boy. You see, pigs are considered unclean animals. The Jewish faith wouldn't let people even touch or eat pigs. And here he finds himself feeding pigs, and not only feeding them, but the stuff that they're eating is actually looking good to him. Jesus uses an interesting phrase here again, this phrase that says hired himself out. He hired himself out to this farmer. It actually means attached himself. This boy attached himself to a local farmer. It brings us to a very important principle that when we walk away from God, we end up enslaved to something else. We end up attached to something else. Some of you know exactly what I'm talking about. You've been feeding your ego for your whole life. You've attached yourself to this idea that your ego is going to be everything for you. But I ask you, how many more positions, how much more status will it take to make you finally happy? Some of you have attached yourself, you've enslaved yourself to greed. And for you, how many more deals, how much more money? When is enough enough? How long are some of you going to keep feeding yourself stuff that doesn't truly satisfy the soul? And if you find yourself in that place where you've been feeding on stuff that's not going to ultimately satisfy you, I encourage you, I challenge you just to say, time out. This is crazy. What am I doing here? How did I end up here? I need to go home. And some of you, frankly, are almost there. Some of you have actually thought about standing up from your pig slop and turning around and coming home. You've considered it, but you're not quite sure what awaits you there. You're not quite sure if it's just kind of a return to this kind of closed-minded religion, this closed-minded system. Maybe God is going to be mad at you. Maybe he's going to expect things of you that you're not quite ready to give. Listen to what the son does. Verse 17, but when he came to himself, he said, how many of my father's hired servants have more than enough bread? But I perish here with hunger. I will arise and go to my father, and I will say to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and before you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Just treat me as one of your hired servants. And he arose, and he came to his father. Listen, the key to this boy in rebellion, the key to every single one of you this morning that finds yourself away from home and in rebellion against your father is this phrase in verse 18. I will arise and go to my father. You see, the way out of rebellion starts with a decision. He finally says, that's it. I'm going home. I'm going home. And no matter where you're at today, no matter how far distant the distant country is that you're in, home is always available. I've seen so many people who seemed so far out of God's reach take this moment where they say, you know what? I'm going to stand up and I'm going to go home. And God will welcome you there. Maybe the most extreme case I've ever seen was a boy named James. I was a youth pastor here at Grace some years ago, and it was right around the time of the Columbine shootings, and so everybody in churches and schools was kind of on high alert. And this boy, James, had been invited by one of our students to come to our youth ministry. And he actually showed up on a Sunday morning. In fact, he was there about 7:30 in the morning. He'd been dropped off early when I actually arrived at the church. And I arrived, and there was already some talk about this strange boy that was in the church. He was about 15 at the time, and he was wearing a long black trench coat, and he carried a backpack on his back. If you remember, at the time of Columbine, man, those were the kind of the two warning signs. This is what the boys came into the school with before they started shooting things up. So everybody was on high alert, and they're saying, well, Derek, you got to go do something. He's just wandering around out in the lobby, looking around, doesn't know what to do. And so I called him into my office, and we had a conversation. I actually asked him if I could check through his backpack to make sure everything was cool. And that moment started a relationship between me and James. A couple weeks later, I ended up out at his house visiting him, and I got just a glimpse into this kid's life. It was brutal. It was dark. He was basically raising himself. The pictures on the walls in his bedroom, I mean, it made me need a brain scrubber when I left. He loved hardcore music, and so I found myself in his house kind of shouting over the pulsating speakers as we were trying to have a conversation together. And his language was rough, and his appearance was rough, and his concept of a father was really screwed up. I'm here to tell you that the incredible grace of God pierced through all of that stuff. I mean, it was during a retreat that we were on. And finally, ultimately, James saw the truth and the relentless tenderness of Jesus pierced through all of that garbage in his life. And he found himself in a group of guys that loved and accepted him for who he was. And he fell to his knees that night. He asked Jesus to be his Savior. And he started his life on a different journey. I remember a couple weeks after that, we were back having one of our normal worship services for youth ministry, and James had kind of found himself down front. His heart was changing. He was trying to figure out what this worship thing looked like, what it meant to follow Jesus. And I remember during one of the worship songs, he kind of spontaneously got up, and he walked up to the front of the stage, and he started dancing. And his version of dance, I mean, he was jumping around. He was doing stuff like, and just going crazy down front. And I remember there were some older brothers who had seen this happen, and some parents that got very upset. And I had meetings that week, and people were leaving the church because that they didn't want their kids exposed to this, and look at how he dressed, and I don't want my kid to be negatively influenced. And there was controversy about the hand signals that he was using when he was worshiping. Was it this that means I love you, or was this that means Satan's horns or whatever? He was dancing down front, and who would be dancing during worship? And I just want to say, there are some times when it's sinful to dance, and there are some times when it is a grave sin not to dance. And he was dancing in the only way that he knew how, in worship to God. About a year later, I got a phone call at 7:45 a.m. that James had been killed in a car accident on his way to school. It was a snowy day, slippery roads. He was driving, and he lost control, went off the road. And I remember at his funeral, the conversations that people were having about the life that was changed in this boy. And it reminded me of a couple things as we think about the prodigal, as we think about people who are far from God. The first is, it reminded me of the power of youth ministry, the power of reaching out to students. Listen, he wound up there at church at a place where he had an opportunity to hear about God because somebody invited him. And if you're a student in this room, I just want to say that there is power in your relationship with people in your school. There is power in an invitation. You can literally change the eternal course of someone's destiny as a result of having the guts of inviting them to something. But also just the onus of responsibility that's on Christians and on churches to make room for the young people in our church. I imagine if we hadn't had a youth ministry, what if our church had the philosophy of saying, well, we're just going to wait until students are a little bit older to expose them to the gospel. We're going to wait 5 years. What would that have meant for James? Our ministry to our students is so vitally important. But it also reminded me that there's no one that's too far from God. I mean, some of you have wandered from God. And true, you haven't blown your last buck, and you haven't wrecked all your relationships, and you haven't burned your last bridge, and you're not feeding on pig slop yet. But some of you know that you haven't been on the right path for a long time. And my question to you is, if you don't change direction now, where are you headed? Where is this path that you're on going to take you? Can I make a plea to you on God's behalf? Before you cross that line, that line that will change everything, and if you're in that place, you know exactly what I'm talking about right now. Before you cross that line that will blow your life apart, why not come home? Why not apply for mercy today? I mean, what are you going to do next? Where else are you going to go from here? More screw-ups, more cover-ups, more lies? I mean, how many more lives are going to have to be negatively affected by your folly? Where is this all headed? Why not stand up to your feet, spin around on your heels, and leave that distant place and come home? I promise that when you are approaching home, that you will look off in the distance and you will see a father in full stride saying, "Welcome home, son. Welcome home, daughter. Through what Christ did for you on the cross, all is forgiven." Before things get any worse, would you please, please consider doing what the prodigal son did and say, "I'm not going to feed from this rotten trough anymore. I'm going to turn around, I'm going to humble myself, and I'm going to head for home." You see, the son understands his sin. He admits his sin, and he starts rehearsing his little speech. He recognizes that there is no way that he can return to his status as son. He's already messed that all up. And so he's not even going to go home and ask his dad to live at home anymore. He's going to ask to be a hired servant, which means he would just live in the local village nearby, and he would travel in to his old house to work each day just to pay off his debt, just to earn a wage so that he can start paying his dad back. Here's a lesson that you need to hear. Don't underestimate the Father's grace. You see, the son, by preparing his speech, he's underestimating the father's grace. He didn't realize that when his father saw him from a far off place, that he was going to come running. And we'll talk much more about that in the weeks to come. But the father lavishes grace upon him like the son couldn't even imagine. He kisses him and he clothes him and he restores him. And it's a scene of forgiveness to end them all. I can't wait to tell you about it. As we consider this kind of coming home, I want to use a different story to illustrate what that actually feels like. Many of you have seen yellow ribbons around that are hung around on trees or homes when there's troops away or when there's hostages in other countries being held. And those ribbons have come to represent this idea that we want them to return home safely. And this tradition started in the early 70s when a New York Post article ran that related this kind of oral tradition of how that practice started. The story goes something like this. There was a group of college students heading to spring break, and they were on their way from New York to Florida. And they were on a bus, and there was a man on the bus from the very beginning. He was sitting toward the front. He was wearing an ill-fitted suit. He never really moved. He just sat there and kind of chewed the inside of his lip a lot. And one of the college girls came up and started to try to get into a conversation with him. And it took a couple of states of traveling, but finally she started getting some information out of him. His name was Vingo, and he was had been in a New York jail for the past 4 years, and he just got out of jail. And she asked him, "Well, are you going home?" And he said, "I don't know." She said, "You don't know?" He said, "Well, when I was in jail, I wrote a letter to my wife. It went something like this. I understand if you can't stay married to me. I'm going to be away for a long time. And if you can't stand it, or if the kids keep asking questions, or if it hurts you too much, just forget me. Get a new guy. Forget about me." And so he said, "I told her she didn't have to write to me or anything, and she hasn't. For 3.5 years, she's not written me once." So the girl says, "Well, you mean you're going home without knowing?" "Yeah," he said. And then he went on and said, "Well, last week when I was sure that the parole was going to come through, I wrote to her again and I told her that if she had a new guy, I understood. But if she didn't, if she would take me back, she should let me know somehow." And so we used to live in this town, Brunswick, and it's just before Jacksonville, and there's a big oak tree when you come into town. It's a very famous tree. It's huge. And I told her that if she'd take me back, that she should put a yellow handkerchief on the tree. And if I saw that yellow handkerchief, I'd know that I was welcome home, and I would go on through. And if not, I would just keep going on my journey, and that I would understand. By this time, the bus was about 20 miles away from Brunswick, and the word had spread through the rest of the students on this trip about this story, and so there was this anticipation in the bus, and all the kids started taking over the window seats on the right side of the bus, waiting for a view of this tree. The bus became hushed, and Vingo turned his head in anticipation and preparing himself for another disappointment. The bus drew near 10 miles and then 5. And then there was the tree. Suddenly, all the young people were up out of their seats and they were screaming and shouting and crying and doing small dance of exultation, all except Vingo. He sat there stunned, not making a noise, just looking at the tree. And it was covered with yellow handkerchiefs and ribbons, 20 of them, 30 of them, hundreds of them. The tree stood like this banner of welcome, blowing in the wind. And as the young people shouted, Vingo rose from his seat and he made his way to the front of the bus because he was going home again. I want to remind you today that no matter who you are, no matter what you've done, no matter where you've been through, no matter what addictions you're carrying, no matter what you're enslaved to, no matter what kind of pig slop you find yourself looking down at, the offer to come home remains for you. Come home.